This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and a man I've been longing to interview, Mr. Music Man himself, Paul Armfield.
How do you do?
Welcome, welcome. It's lovely to have you. So you are a real face on the music scene on the island and have been for many years, despite being born in Birmingham.
Yes.
Yeah, so yes. Tell us, how did that all come about?
I left Birmingham when I was about 10. We moved to the Isle of Wight, and I come from a long line of footballers, and I was hopeless and never any good at football, so I was quite relieved when we moved to the island and nobody seemed that bothered about football. Well, obviously come from Birmingham, it's all, everyone lives and breathes football, but I always loved music, and there was always music in the house, music was, it was a big relief when I sort of came down here, and music became my thing. And when I was about 12, we formed a punk band with some friends, and we, before we had instruments even, and so we went and brought our instruments, learned to play them, you know, from copying records, and then just it had sort of moved on from there. I learned to play French horn at school, at Ventnor Middle School, for a little while, and then gave that up for the bass guitar. Yeah, so and then it's just been, I've moved off the island subsequently, but it's always been the music scene on the island, I think, that's brought me back, or certainly my friends within the music scene. Yeah. You know, it's, there's a certain camaraderie amongst musicians generally, especially on the island. I think the island hasn't got a competitive music scene like other places may have. It's a much more supportive environment, with everyone sort of backing everybody else up and everybody playing with everybody else, and it's just that I love that sense of community, and I think that's, as much as anything, is what's always pulled me back to the island.
Yeah. Oh. So are those your peers that you grew up with, are they still playing, are you still making music with them?
Actually, the people I started playing with early on aren't, no, but still, you know, I mean, I've been playing music with JC Grimshaw since we were at school.
So this is of
Angelina and JC. I've been playing
with
both of them since I was at school, really. So although we weren't at school together, we started, you know, during that time playing in bands together.
And what about, because you've got a beautiful voice, is that self-taught? Or?
It is self-taught, and I never had a good voice, and I always wanted to be a singer, and one of my first bands I was the singer in, because I wanted to be, you know, the front man, but I never had a voice, and it was rubbish, and I, you know, you always remember your bad reviews, but I remember a friend of mine early on saying, Paul, I think you should get some singing lessons, and so I stopped singing in a band, and then when I formed Bobby I Can Fly with Duncan Jones, you know, there was never any thought of me singing, because he had such a beautiful voice. And I didn't really start singing until I was in my 30s, and I did some recording, and the recordings, I'd sort of started singing in a different way.
And did you take lessons then? Did you take advice?
No. I just started, I don't know, sort of imitating, I suppose, the singers that I liked. And the singers that I liked were not really singers. So they were usually either songwriters who ended up singing by accident, or musicians who ended up singing by accident. So I had no real training. People like Nat King Cole, people like Chet Baker, you know, who singing was secondary to their main instrument.
Yes.
People like Hoagy Carmichael, Jack Teagarden, and those, and there was something I liked about their quality of singing, that it wasn't trained, that it was almost slightly spoken, and that it was a little bit closer and more intimate, and it was more about the expression. I think they expressed more with their lack of talent. The technique didn't get in the way of their singing. Okay. I think that's what I liked about them.
Yeah.
And there was something a little bit more human and a little bit more intimate, I think, about their singing style. So I suppose imitating those, which is why I suppose when I sing I have got a slight American accent in there, which I've tried to get rid of over the years.
Oh, you definitely have. Yes.
Yeah.
Last night,
yeah.
but a lot of your lyrics have a spoken word quality about them. Mm. You were talking about rather sort of talking the lyrics rather than singing them, and they're very poetic, aren't they?
Mm.
Where did that writing inspiration come from?
I've always loved words as well. I think that's the, you know, I've always loved words, and the songs I've liked specifically generally tend to have words that have jumped out at me. And I think, you know, I always think that the job of art and of poetry is to make things strange, and is to put, you know, because we use words all the time, they're our bluntest instrument, you know, as artists, because, you know, they lose their meaning, and to give words meaning and it's quite a difficult thing, and I think it's hard enough as a poet to do that, but I think actually as a songwriter, it's easier to do, because you can. You have the music and the place of, you know, where you place those words and the way you pronounce those words and the way the rhythm works with the words. You can put unexpected things in there and just make them jump out a little bit more. And those are the songs that I love. I love it when that happens. And it does, you know, you do hear things for the first time.
What particular one springs to mind?
I don't know, some of those great songs, some of those, all those great American songbook, you know, the... There's some beautiful lines. I try and think of now. I mean, songs like "I Get Along Without You Very Well" is a good example. You know, it's
a story almost, isn't it?
It's absolutely, it's a story, and it turns an idea on its head, and you get the irony.
Yes.
You get, you know, you understand the meaning behind the words that on the paper you might not do, but actually within the song, because the way the song. Because the way the words fall within the music, you know, it adds extra meaning, and you can convey the message between the lines a lot easier.
It's quite interesting when another artist covers an original piece, isn't it? And they put a totally different spin almost on the same words and the same notes.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, and that's that actually the song I mentioned, "I Get Along With You Without You Very Well," is a case in point, because the first time I heard that was a very upbeat, quick tempo version, and I didn't hear the sadness in it. I thought it was literally and I suppose that was the idea, was to make it I'm fine, thanks, yeah, jolly good. Whereas actually it's a really sad song about a woman who's just left her husband, her husband has just died, you know. So it, but. But I've always loved lyrics. I've loved, you know, and I think in the post-punk era, there were lots of great lyricists, the likes of Elvis Costello. It was a great, great lyricist, and I think that there's been a tradition that not necessarily in English music, certainly in French music, that, you know, my main heroes, songwriting heroes, tend to be the French chansonniers, because they are. The French allow you to take yourself seriously, whereas in English you're not necessarily allowed to. If you take yourself too seriously, there's people like to pull you up on that. Yeah. But I think in France, obviously, you know, they love it. They love the more serious and earnest and you are the better. And also the thing that I always loved about French songs is that they show man's frailty much more than the English or the American tradition, where the protagonist of the song is usually the hero, or worse, the sort of, you know, poor, hard done by victim, where in French songs the central character is quite often pathetic. I mean, they show, like I say, they show man up for all his frailties, and I quite like that. I think that's something that songs can do, I like that.
They point to the truths in our lives, don't they? The things we can relate to, and hence they become the soundtrack. Everybody has a different soundtrack to their life, really, don't
yes.
they? Through the a lot of popular music. And when I was listening, researching you coming on, and I was listening to some of your music last night online, and there's one that got thousands of hits, and rightly so. It's called "Under the Linden," and you've got a beautiful photo, black and white, with a little girl, I think it's taken in the 1940s, and she's holding the hand either side of two older women. And it's this beautiful version of how a child sees adults. You know, this very different way in her thoughts, yet it's very mature, and I loved it. It's just a really beautiful piece of work.
Thank you. I have to say that, you know, it's something that I sort of it's a bit of a strange ambition, but in my songs, I really like songs that make people cry, and I have to say I'm very pleased to say that I've looked out at the audience during that songs many a time and seen people crying, and it, because, you know, I think it actually does. It's very melancholic. It's very nostalgic. It's very much about the relationship with it's about, in that particular photograph, that song, because it's a song about a photograph. You know, it's about the relationship with the mother and the grandmother, and about the generations, and about the girl in the middle growing through those generations. And in one line in the song, she says, "You know, I'm older than my grandmother now." You know, in that photograph, and looking back, I still feel like the same person as the little girl, and it's
something we can all relate to, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. You feel the distance between you and your younger self is doesn't seem that far as it does between your younger self and the adults that you look up to.
Or indeed, when somebody looks at you, they see the yawning gap, don't
yes
they?
Yeah, absolutely.
One doesn't,
yeah.
Sadly. But that brings me on to my next point, which is I think you were just saying that photo was an inspiration for the lyrics of the song. And a friend of mine, singer-songwriter Annie Robinson, she asked me she was very excited that you were coming on, and she asked me to ask you, have you got any solution for writer's block?
Well, yeah, definitely. And I think that part of it, well, not that I had writer's block, actually, I have to say, but part of the reason I did this last project, and the last project I did was an album called Found, and I wrote a whole album about photographs, the found photographs, the photographs that my a friend of mine in Berlin, she's been collecting photographs that she finds in flea markets for years. And of course, you know, all the history of Berlin, East and West, and you know, there's obviously, you know, what's captured there is incredible, and she has an exceptional eye for photographs. And so I just thought it would be nice, rather than write another album about myself, which the previous album was very much about me approaching middle age.
Is that a cheerful album, Paul?
Well, yeah, actually, yeah, it was, because I really liked being middle-aged, and I think I've said before, you know, that I really like the vantage point. It feels to me like a high point where you look down on either side. You've got youth down one side, old age on the other, and you can see I think it's a good vantage point to see the world from. And I, you know, I actually quite like getting older, perversely. But anyway, but so I just thought, and also I could write about nothing else, you know, because that was what was concerning me. I was seeing my parents grow older, I was seeing my children grow up, and you know, those are the, you know, you do really feel, like I say, right in the middle of it all,
yes,
at middle age,
indeed.
And you see that, and you've got life going out and life coming in, and
almost at the top of the hill, aren't
you,
looking down,
exactly that,
looking down both ways, really.
And so that was what I wrote about, with intentionally or not, at that point. And then for this album, I sort of wanted to write something different and do a different project. And my friend had got these photographs that she would post up occasionally on Facebook, and she'd got a Flickr site with them all on. And I was just astounded by this bit of photograph. She just had, like I say, this eye, and she would, and each of these photographs would have so much in them. They were. A whole novel each. You could have written a whole novel about each of these photographs. They were so inspiring, and you could, the stories behind them, and there was mystery, and the whole idea of found photographs and photographs being thrown away, and what happened to these people, not knowing about them, especially with this extra frisson of what we knew was going on historically in the background of these photos. That was really inspiring. So it was almost impossible to have writer's block with that.
Yes.
But the way I did it, and I think is a way I quite like to work, is to, when I was, I just sat on a train looking at these photographs, because I was on tour on a with the train, so I had a lot of time to myself. And just looking at these photos, I had them all on my phone, and I'd come across a photograph that I thought, oh, that's a good one. And I'd start writing just notes about. So not like a song, not to write a song, I'd just make notes.
Yeah.
But actually what would happen, sometimes a song would come out of it. Sometimes there and then, sometimes it'd just be notes. But actually when I came back down to sit down with a and to say, right, today I'm writing a song, and that's generally how I work. I write to order. I sit down and say, right, song today, and then I've got all these notes, so I'm not working with a blank canvas, that I've got something to work on.
To pull and draw on, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's where the inspiration comes from, isn't it? That's how you overcome writer's block, is that you're completely like a sponge, take everything in, and then utilise it and mine the bit that you want to, that's interesting to you at the time.
Also, I like letting accidents happen, so sometimes I will just sit and I've got nothing, no idea, and I'll just strum away, play away, pick away, and sometimes just a word will come, from that. And
so where are you dealing words? You said you love words. I'm just interested because I'm a writer, but I'm not a musician and could no way do what you guys do. Why wouldn't you write poetry, for example, or do you write poetry?
I used to, and actually most of the poems I wrote turned into songs.
Yes, because to me they're poems set to music. Is that
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've got, to be honest, although I enjoy poetry and I do read a bit of poetry, I've got no ambition to write poetry at all. I think it's because it's a form that even though I understand and I appreciate, I don't necessarily feel that I get it totally, that I understand it, that I could ever be confident enough to stand up and say, oh, I've written a poem and read it, because I feel that it's a very, all the poetry and I do get invited to play at poetry events and things because people appreciate the poetry in my lyrics, and when people get up and read their poetry, I don't know, I feel there's a different criteria, a different judgment that's being made. I think poets tend to also read to other poets, so the audience at most poetry events are other poets.
I think we'd like them to be other people as well. Yeah, I know. Poets.
But it seldom is.
Yes.
And I think that's a difficult thing. It is, that the people who read poetry generally are people who are interested in poetry and writing poetry themselves. So I suppose what it does. But, with the music, it reaches more people, and it's a more immediate thing, I think, perhaps, like I say, because of the extra clout that the music can give the word sometimes.
And it's interesting that, some people, they will latch onto just the music, won't they? And they'll hum that, and they'll remember that. Haven't really got a clue what the song's about, but it's a catchy tune. And likewise, I suppose I'm the opposite. I'll listen to the words, and less so the music behind it. So when you're writing, and when you've finished a piece, do you, forgive this question, it's a bit naive, but like I say, I'm not musical, do you have an equal weighting? Do you think, yes, those words are equal to the music and the music's equal to the words, or does it just vary?
I don't know. I never let the music get in the way of the words. I'd say the words come first, the music is secondary. I would say the words are more important than the music, but actually it's funny because when I've written a song, it's always almost impossible to judge a song when I've written it. Songs that I've thought were brilliant the next day I think are terrible, and songs that I think are terrible the next day I think are wonderful. Also, songs that I'm not that happy with, the audience always seems to enjoy more. The songs that I'm really, really proud of, sometimes the audience never gets the response that I'd hope it would do. I mean, it's an absolute mystery, and the songs do tend to have a life of their own, and they evolve. And some songs that, like I say, that I thought weren't much at all, over time, playing them over time, they've sort of developed a life of their own, and they've evolved, and they work. And some songs that work live don't work on recorded. It's a strange one, really. Like I say, they're all individual creatures, I think.
It interested me something you said earlier, that you have this almost like workmanlike approach to music, that you can write to order. fact.
Well, that's because I've always been busy, and I like being busy. You know, it inspires me to get things done. The busier I am, so when I worked, I worked, spent 20 years working at Otterkers, and that then became Waterstones. I had to very much compartmentalise my life because my music career was running alongside for the last 10 years of that. I had a young family, and actually finding time to write was difficult because it does need a space, and you do need, I think, to be focused on it all the time. You need to be tuned in, to have your antennas turned on, so you're picking up and being responsive to what's going in. So for a couple of albums, actually, I did say, okay, I've got a week to write a song. A week to write the album and a week to record it.
Nothing like a deadline.
Nothing like a deadline, exactly that. Because I didn't feel, it's not the sort of thing I come home from work at the end of the day and I think, oh, I'm going to write a song tonight. No, it was never like that. There was never, as I come home from the end of the day and I'm with my family. So I need to sort of find the time, a chunk of time to focus and say, right, this is what I'm doing now. Fortunately, I've got a very understanding family and I managed to create opportunities to do that. So I remember the second album, I'd had surgery in hospital and had to have a couple of weeks off that I couldn't go into work and use that time to write the songs for the second album. And then we went in and we booked a week because I could only really afford a week in the studio, and we just recorded in a week. And so, that most of the albums are being done that quickly. Mm.
And I've read here that you write songs for people in the audience. You write songs for gifts and for celebrations.
Yeah.
That's a lovely thing to do, isn't it? It's a lovely gift you have in order to give to other people.
Well, again, it's the case of a blank. It's a deadline. Deadlines are always good for creativity, exactly. And always. Also, it's not a blank canvas. So all you're doing is forming something out of something that somebody's given you. So there's a limit to what you can do. Now the first, I sort of jumped in head first and. Went to a festival where I was going to do that, write songs about the audience. And what I found was, actually, some of those songs have really stood up. Not as great pieces of work, but actually something that's really enjoyable for the audience. And the thing is, when you're writing, sometimes you can be... you can over-edit, and I don't like doing that, and I'm not one for doing that, but you can edit the life out of something completely. And you could self-edit, and you self-censor as well. When you're writing, you self-censor, you think, no, that's not good enough. No, I can't do that, I can't do that, I can't do that. When you've got to write two songs a day, which was the task I gave myself at this one festival, about people in the audience, that actually you haven't got time to think too much about it. And actually what happens as a result is you write things that your more critical self wouldn't have written, but actually sometimes your instinct is right.
Yes, I think you've got to give yourself permission, haven't you? To get it down, to get it out.
Yes.
And like you said, just to walk away from it and then go back, but perhaps leave well alone, otherwise it does become such a dog's dinner, doesn't
yes.
it? And then you start to question yourself, which is never the best place to be.
No.
So when you wrote these pieces, I presume the members of the audience got to hear them?
Yeah, I performed. What we did, so we this particular instance they were referring to, I would go on stage at lunchtime, perform a few songs, then invite people from the audience onto the stage and ask them questions, and the audience would also ask questions. And I'd got some cards prepared in case there was a lack of questioning, but that we'd ask the questions, and they were sort of funny and entertaining questions. It was a nice process, actually, and I did that with two members of the audience each lunchtime. Go away, write two songs in the afternoon, and perform them in the evening. So we did. I did two a day over a 3-day period, it was great fun, actually. And then recorded them and put them on the website.
It must have been delighted. I mean, what a gorgeous, very flattering, I would imagine.
I think so. I think it was interesting. And a couple of those songs I still dig out, because they, you know, they've like I say, they worked as they were as little vignettes, little things that have not of, and I won't say they were of no consequence, because actually some of them, you know, some of the material I had to work with was brilliant. There was one chap who would the first one I wrote actually was a chap who was who used to be in the army and had a family, and then left his family, left the army, and started writing poetry and studying geology, and became a specialist who would go along when they discovered unexploded bombs, and just and you know, tell them about the type of ground, yes, they were working in and stuff. So it was absolutely a transformative story, and it was brilliant. You know, it was gold really for a songwriter. But there's always gold for a songwriter, I think, in everything, if you just look, you know, if you're looking in the right places. But
I think I'd far rather be in an audience with you writing songs for members of the audience than that awful feeling you get when you're in a comedy gig. The comic sort of focuses on you and then decides to pick you apart. Of course, you could never think of a witty riposte.
No, I know.
In this circumstances.
Yeah, no, that's it. That's the worst experience. And I hate that. I dislike audience participation of any sort, if I'm honest. I don't go to be a part of it. I go to watch.
Exactly.
Except there are, you know, obviously there's times when I like to involve the audience, but, you know, and to make them feel warm and welcome. And I'm, like I said, I'm glad in those situations that actually people felt comfortable enough to come forward. Because I think, one thing I can do, and I'm not blowing my own trumpet, but certainly in the right environment, I can create a nice cozy atmosphere, you know, that makes people feel warm. Yeah.
Can you play the trumpet, Paul?
I can. No, well, funny enough, I can't. Well, I can. I can get a tune out of it, and certainly when I'm recording, I can enough to do some.
So you can blow your own trumpet, rightly so.
Yeah.
Well, more of this after the break, and I'll be asking Paul Armfield, my special guest today, all about his new role at Key Arts. Thank you. Speak soon.
Stay social and get in touch. Add us on Skype. It's vectis.radio. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very, very special guest, Paul Armfield. You get a very extra very, very there. And we've spoken a lot about the music you make, and I know now you've also, and you really are a hard worker, you've taken on a brand new role at Key Arts, haven't you, recently. So tell us all about that.
It was something I have always fancied doing, and I love the place, and did actually work there about 30 years ago, or more actually. For a company called Blow Your Own Trumpet, funny enough.
Great.
It's been fairly central to my whole life, actually. It's revolved, I suppose, in some way around the Key. You know, it's been quite a constant that's been there, and I've, you know, I've had parties and, you know, gigs and all sorts, you know, have gone on there. That I've been to, and just always fancied doing it. Always felt quite, like an awful lot of people do, feel very close to it and very attached to it, and you know, it matters. And so, when the job came up about 2 years ago now, I did think of going for it, and I thought, no, I can't. I was in the middle of making this album, Found. And, you know, when I'd left Waterstones, I'd left to concentrate on my music career. And the music career was going okay. It was doing all right. You know, I was touring regularly. I was in the middle of making this album. It was, you know, being it was self-funding. You know,
brilliant.
It was certainly not a failure. And it had worked out exactly as I planned. And the Found album was just about to come out. Well, I was in the middle of working on it, and so I didn't go for the job, and also didn't think I'd get it. There'd been a few times when I was at Waterstones that I'd thought of going for the job when it came up, because it's come up a few times, obviously, over the last 20 years. and was either talked out of it or just decided now was not the time to go for it, and didn't think I'd get it for that matter, to be honest.
Why the lack of confidence?
Not a lack of confidence necessarily. I just didn't think I was the person for it, because I remember once I wanted to go, and I went to speak to whoever was the current manager at the time about it, and they basically talked me out of it. They said, "Oh, the amount of bureaucracy and paperwork that was involved was off-putting. It was not the job that I wanted."
I see.
And so I thought, certainly I'm not qualified for that. I don't have that experience specifically of the art world. Although, you know, obviously I knew the artistic community on the island, certainly the literary community and the musical community, as well as you know, many of the artists and poets and the likes. So, you know, in that place, in that way, I've always felt well placed to do a job to do the job. But certainly, you know, the art world is a completely different world, and runs in a very different way. So anyway, for one reason or another, I was always put off going for it, and then when it came up as a part-time job, advertised as a part-time job about 6 months ago, the Found album was out and had done really well, and I thought, actually, I could probably do this. I could put, you know, as a part-time job, I think I could do it. And I know that, you know, that the kid had a hard time, and I knew it was on its way up again, and I was very, you know, positive and optimistic about it. So I went for the job and got the job, and yeah, I mean, part time it's not.
No, it never is, is it?
It's
part time pay, full time work.
Absolutely, and I have to say, it is pretty much at the moment every waking hour. And you know, that's not just I'm not saying that idly. It is every waking hour. You know, I do wake up thinking about it, and I go to bed thinking about it.
Is that because you are very conscientious and you live and breathe it, which I imagine you would a job like that, somebody
yeah.
like you who is an artist?
Certainly,
you're bringing something else.
I know that there was what I set out to do, which was what we launched in October, was, you know, my feeling has always been that the quay should be open in the evenings, and that it should be open at weekends, and that there should be lots happening there, that theatre should never be empty, and that you know, as a venue, the gallery should have more people in there, and you know, that it should be visited more, as a business, if I was a businessman come to the island and saw that venue with a fully equipped kitchen and a beautiful cafe,
yes,
like that,
yes.
and the terrace on the river.
Oh, it's a stunning venue, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly.
Stunning resource for us.
That it is exactly a resource and should be able to sustain itself. Because obviously everyone knows the problem that the quay has had is that it used to be government funded, council funded. And then when the funding stopped, you know, it became very difficult, as with a lot of art centres across the country. And so, but I always thought, I was certainly of the belief that it could be self-sustaining with the cafe alone, you know, given the site and the location and how beautiful it is.
I had some gorgeous food there the other night, and I'm not just saying it, you know, I'm really, really fussy, but goodness me, it was heaven. I think it was just beautiful. We descended on the table like a plague of locusts, and that was it, gone. It was gorgeous.
Well, that's very, very nice. I mean, no, I have
You
to
don't
say,
do that as well, do you, Paul? You don't turn your hand in the kitchen?
I have been.
Wow.
A little bit. There's been a few times when I've had to, but certainly, you know, it's not my forte. But, you know, it's one of those jobs with so few staff that, you know, everyone has to chip in at some point.
So if people, any artists listening, if they've got an idea for a show or an exhibition, the next port of call is to contact you?
Yeah, absolutely. Just my whole modus operandi is really that I want it to be, I don't want to do any work. Ultimately, you know, I will make it a part-time job again. It will, you know, but it needs the things that work most and the work best are things that other people are doing. So, for example, we have the Folk Night, which is run by John Bentley, who's doing that. You know, people with a passion for something come and do it.
Yeah.
So there are several events. Graham Brown is doing the poetry night. If anyone has any interest in anything that they want to put on, we had the Chalk Pit Records. Silas came and organised a night for Chalk Pit Records, which was absolutely fantastic. So all these things that other people are doing, come and tell me. If you've got an idea, we'll make it happen.
So I don't think there's any limit on talent on the island, from what I've seen, but there, I think it's money is always the problem, isn't it? So how do you get around that one?
And money is the problem. There's lots of free things that happen, and here's the thing: money's not the only currency. And I've played at the Quay many times for free, and I'm more than happy to, partly because it's been a joy, and partly because there's been really good audiences.
But from the other side, I was meaning, how does the venue sustain itself if the artists don't have to hire? Do they hire the room?
Yes, they do. Yeah. Well, there are many ways of doing it, and this is one of the things. As an artist myself, I've played there for free.
Yes.
As an artist myself, I've played there and been paid. As an artist myself, I've also hired the venue out. So there's no one way of doing it. It depends what you want and if you've been invited to do it or if you want to use the venue for something you have. So there's no one way. I can't say, this is how it happens. And that's the same with any venue, whether sometimes you hire the artist, sometimes the artist hires you. That's how it works. And every shade of in between. So, but the rest, it depends. I mean, it's a very...
it's a bit of a movable feast, isn't it?
Absolutely a movable feast. What I'm saying is, in terms of the art, getting artists to perform, one, the venue is a big attraction because it's a nice venue, because we are fairly well equipped. We've got a decent PA that people can use with that doesn't cost them to hire out or whatever, that it's a fairly easy experience for a performer, say, if we're talking about a musician coming in. But things like Acoustic Originals and Eclectic Electrics and the Jazz Jam, that's about coming along and making music for the right reasons, not because you're going to get paid at the end of the night.
Oh, no.
But because you're going to play to a nice audience and the audience is going to be respectful. It's not like going into a pub where you're fighting to be heard above the noise. That's certainly a gig at the Quay, certainly any of those nights that we're talking about, you will be listened to, and the audience will appreciate that opportunity to hear a band in a decent environment.
I performed at Graham's poetry night the other week, and it's a beautiful space up there, isn't it, the theatre? It really is. And like you say, it's very calm. People know what they're getting. They come and they behave in that way. They're very receptive to what the artists are doing.
Yes.
Yes.
And because it's an art centre, and that's what it is. But also at the same time, I'm trying to get people in who wouldn't normally come to an art centre, because that's the thing. It is inclusive, and it's one thing to say that it's inclusive and another thing to actually make it inclusive, because it's not just about saying to people, no, it is inclusive, come along, because of course it's like I say, it's easy to say that, but the thing I'm trying to do is that to actually create enough things that will bring people in who wouldn't normally be there.
Yeah, I think that must be quite a challenge. I was talking last week on the show to Jack Whitewood, who's the artistic director at the Exchange in Ventnor, and he said he felt his biggest competition wasn't other venues and what was going on there, but the sofa.
Yeah.
Facebook, the TV, whatever people decide they're going to stay in for.
Yeah.
That's what he was battling.
Yeah. No, it is, absolutely. Why go out and pay for something when you can get it for free, at home, in the comfort of your own home? And that is exactly right. And Jack's a big influence on me, actually, because what he's doing over there is absolutely fantastic, and he's a very smart.
He's very switched on,
smart
isn't he?
Character, and he talks a lot of sense. And there's always some substance behind any decision he makes, and I think what he's doing is absolutely fantastic. And I think for certainly not just for the younger generation, but the younger generation, having them on the island is absolutely priceless. Because there was for me growing up, I suppose the Quay was the Quay was that place for me. But again, that wasn't just for younger people, it wasn't run by young people, and I think on the island, because we have no university, because I think the sixth forms are, you know, are separate from the schools for the most part. The people, younger people on the islands have, don't have those aspirational role models that, you know, and they don't get to experience an alternative from the usual pub environment or whatever, you know, to aspire to. There's not, you know, when you get to a certain age, you know, that's, the pub is the only venue for you.
Yes.
You know, there's no other social opportunity. And I think, you know, although the exchange certainly offers that and shows people that there is an alternative to, like I say, that usual pub environment. And hopefully the Key can do the same and should do, you know, that they should, you know, people growing up who've got a bit of just should know that there are places they can go that actually, you know, are a nice environment that aren't, you know, gonna fleece you, or you know, or that you can actually get something entertaining that for free, you know. And most of the events at the Key that we're doing are free.
Yes, I went to one the other night, which was brilliant. You showed That'll Be the Day with David Essex, and you had, was it the Professor of Film from Portsmouth University?
Yeah, talk about it. Yeah.
And I found that fascinating. Obviously, it was shot mainly on the island, wasn't it? Which I didn't know when I saw it back in the day. And I just found the whole thing, I thought it was lovely, but what saddened me was there was only such a small audience for a fantastic free night.
Well, the unfortunate thing about film is that we're not allowed to charge for it. And because of the licence that we've got, we're not allowed to advertise it outside the building. So that's quite a difficult thing. Even me talking about it now is probably wrong. But
we're not having this conversation.
No,
don't
but
worry.
It is. That, so that's quite difficult. So it has to be advertised in house. However, even when the cinema was, you know, being paid for, and I know in the past that it could be, you know, the cinema has always been a difficult one for the Key. You know, that to get people out for one showing is of, it's quite difficult. So I don't know what we do about that. Certainly some things work better than others, and I want to get it to a state that we can do both.
I think it was nice having the Professor of Film there, because that added another dimension to it. It was really interesting. He did a sort of pre-film talk, and then once we'd watched the movie, we could chat to him afterwards, and it was brilliant.
Well, this is the thing, you know, as I've said, that I don't want to... It's not going to be about me and inflicting my taste on the public. It's got to be about facilitating people with some level of expertise or some interest or some passion to come and do it. So for the cinema, certainly on the Tuesday night cinema, it's a selection of people who do know about film or have got some expertise or can talk about it. And
so just turn up, really.
Yeah, and they choose the film.
Okay. Yeah. I actually didn't realise you weren't allowed to talk about it. I thought it was a really clever kind of mystery marketing project that you were doing. I thought, what a great idea, you know, it's getting us all wound up and we're all going to go.
No. Well, I hope, you know, that will be ultimately the effect, that, you know, it becomes this clandestine gathering.
Yeah, secret knock on the back door. Yeah. But you were talking about the younger people and, you know, having inspiration, having lovely venues to go to, and that brings me on to something we were chatting about off air earlier, which is about your daughter, Alice Armfield, who you were telling me has got an exhibition at Dimbola.
Yeah, we've been over there this morning setting it up. It's her first exhibition, and, you know, what a prestigious place to be exhibiting for a young photographer.
Following the footsteps of the great and the good.
Yes, yeah.
In Freshwater. Lovely.
And it's fantastic, and it's following on... She won last year Student Photographer of the Year, which was a very, you know, fantastic, prestigious prize.
Yes.
And it was with a picture that she took of some friends of ours, Johnny and Kim Grimshaw, in their home, which is, you know, it's a beautiful home, but it looked like a Dutch Renaissance painting. It was beautiful. The lighting was great, and a lovely composition and a great photo with natural light of two people in their environment, you know. And she liked this, and then when I took a few more pictures of people on the island, that, you know, family, friends, that in their home, and it became a bit of a series. So it's nice that it's at Dimbola, and it's of creative people on the island in their home, and it's called a comfort zone.
Comfort zone.
It is people within their comfort zone.
And how long is that running for?
That's running till the 1st of January, yeah.
Is that a free exhibition?
Free exhibition, it's in the cafe, yeah.
Mm. Oh, lovely, brilliant. So, nice cup of tea and a bit of cake.
Yes.
Always a main incentive for me. Yeah. And get to see the sea and get to see your daughter's... where did she train, incidentally?
Well, she's studying at Portsmouth at the moment. She's in her second year at Portsmouth University, yeah.
And is that something she wants to be a professional photographer, presumably?
I think so, yeah. I mean, photographer's her thing. Photography is her thing. I mean, she's a very shy girl, and we sort of noticed early on that she loved, you know, she liked being part of a group, but not necessarily being at the centre of the group, and was always an observer and very fond of people. And so sort of early on, we sort of thought a camera would be...
What a good idea.
A good present. I mean, she always showed an interest, you know, in wanting to do it, and I'm really pleased, yeah, because it does suit her personality, you know, being on the, and it gives her confidence actually behind a camera, you know, once she's got a camera in front of her, she's very
almost
confident.
She's there but not there, isn't she?
Yes,
she's
yeah.
got that between her and her subject, so it's very interesting.
She's a smart girl, she has a really good eye. I mean, of course, proud father talking, but you know, she does have a very good eye, and I have to say that I think one of the things about, she's got a very kind eye as well, so she does tend to bring out the best in people in her photographs, yeah.
Well, that's lovely. So that's Comfort Zone at
Dimbola,
and that runs until the new year.
Yeah.
Fantastic, lovely. And just one thing I want to ask you, you've done all this wonderful music, and yet, you know, I know you love the island. You've lived here most of your life. Apart from, and I've got to ask you, this revolution period you had in revolutionary Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
What was all that about?
Basically, what that was about, I went to university late because I stayed on the island because I was in bands, and when I left sixth form and should have gone off to university to art school, which I would have liked to have done, I stayed on the island playing in a band because I was in a band called Bobby I Could Fly, and things were looking quite optimistic for us, and we were all enjoying playing anyway, so I stayed around, and when the band split up, I was still on the island. I was working for social services at the time, and my life had sort of taken a step in the wrong direction, I think, really, and I ended up going to university because I felt, well, maybe I should. Didn't really know what I was doing. I think, to be honest, I was lost without music.
So what did you do at uni? What did you study?
I went and studied communication in Bournemouth, and I didn't like Bournemouth. I didn't like the course. I wasn't in a happy place. I wasn't, you know, that comfortable with myself.
No,
I didn't know where I was. And I didn't know what I was going to do, and this was just as the wall had come down in Berlin, and things were starting to, that was having a knock-on effect, obviously, and I was probably my lowest ebb in my life, and I went back for my second year at university to confirm, because I knew I didn't like it, but I thought, I'll give it another shot. And I went back, and I just thought, actually, you know, this is not for me. This isn't for me. What am I going to do? I didn't know what I was doing with my life. I'd really reached a complete nadir in my life. And a friend of mine had just been decided. He'd finished university. He'd gone straight from school to university. He'd finished and didn't know what he was going to do, and came back to the Isle of Wight one summer and ended up teaching TEFL at the college.
Oh yes, yes.
and so he loved it, and then went round Europe trying to find a job because he didn't have any qualifications. Couldn't get a job, and they said, "Oh, but if you go to Czechoslovakia, as it then was, they've just had the revolution. They're crying out for English people to teach in their schools." So he went over there and was having a fantastic time. And so I just wrote to him and said, "Can you get me a job?" And he said, yeah. And he got me a job, and within 2 months I was out there. I'd left university, I went and earned some money in London for a couple of months, paid off my debts, and went out and spent the best well, not the best 2 years of my life. I've had wonderful, wonderful times, but up to that point, the best 2 years of my life, yeah, was fantastic in Bratislava, and a fantastic time. Yeah, a fresh start for them, fresh start for me. It was perfect.
So, would you say that was better? Well, it sounds like it was clearly better for you than staying at uni.
Oh, absolutely! It was the best education. I learned more about myself. I learned more about the world. I learned more about everything in that time.
And would you say now, you know, with these hideously high uni fees, obviously your daughter is at Portsmouth, but overall, would you say, you know, it's something, you know, I think our generation would really encourage to go to university, but do you think there's other opportunities, other options for people?
I'd recommend everyone to go and travel, certainly young people to go and travel and learn some independence. I think it's the best way to mature. I think it gives you a perspective that you won't get, and I think if you ever go for a job afterwards, you know, having been an employer for a long time, you know, I've seen a million CVs, and nothing stands out more than a young person who's been travelling or lived elsewhere. For one, it gives you something to talk about at an interview.
Yes.
And two, it just shows a bit of independent spirit. It shows that they will have a better perspective of things, that they won't, you know, that they'll have a bit of get up and go. And I think it's the most impressive thing on a CV.
Oh, that's really interesting advice. Well, good luck with your new role at Key Arts.
Thank you.
Sort of bedded in there a bit more now, aren't
you?
Very, very best of luck, and with your keep making your beautiful music
for
us all and entertaining us here. And we look forward to hearing lots more from you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Been a joy. Thank you. And thank you so much for listening. And please join me again next week when my guest will be Rebecca Blanchfield, who runs Baby Chino in Newport. So it's a lovely place where the kids can play safely and mums can chill with a coffee and a piece of cake. So she's going to come and tell us all about that and her other entrepreneurial activities. And look forward to that. So have a wonderful weekend and stay safe and happy. Bye-bye now. www.vectisradio.com